Welcome. My name is Patrick Curran, and along with my locally misidentified friend Greg Hancock, we make up Quantitude. We are a podcast dedicated to all things quantitative, ranging from the relevant to the completely irrelevant. In this week's episode, Greg and I discuss the assessment of global versus local model fit, and we argue that although global measures of fit can be useful, carefully assessing local fit may be of much greater importance in practice. Along the way, we also discuss cheap beach house rentals, misplaced sand dunes, Mrs. Lincoln, the child catcher, hush puppies, cockroach feces, academia as community theater, spikes and smooges, opening paragraphs, dark and stormy nights, sharp rusty knives, dream teams, dags as religion, no daggety, burly moles, western Kansas, good bones, and computer defaults. We hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Now, you and I have recorded so many times. Well, I think I actually know the number, right? Around 150. And your background is almost always the same. Today, you have a different background. What's going on with you?
I do. I am in Nags Head, North Carolina.
Ooh.
My kids are both at college, but the powers that be thought it was a good idea to have their spring break separated by 1 week.
Right.
We got a midweek rental at the beach where we're going to try to overlap this weekend. We are at a lovely beach house on the Outer Banks in North Carolina. It's really great because it's off season. Now, unfortunately, nothing is open, but you can rent a house for like 25 cents on the dollar because nobody wants it at this time of year. But it's really funny because it is gorgeous. It's right on the Atlantic Ocean. But right now, I am sitting in the main living area looking out the giant plate glass windows right into the back of a sand dune.
What?
Just to be clear, I appreciate the environment.
Uh-huh.
I understand that the sand dunes protect the houses from the ocean. That's all good. I'm pro sand dune. But could you not have bulldozed like 10 feet off the top just so that while I'm talking to you, I could look out on the ocean? Would that have killed you?
The house is lovely. The location is lovely. But you're staring at a big sand dune. That's it.
So other than that, right, it's one of the greatest jokes of all time. Well, yeah. But other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, did you enjoy the play?
And so other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
It's funny because it starts making you think about all the things where either it's amazingly good except for this one tiny detail, or vice versa, because I have one of each of those. So one, do you remember the movie Chitty Chitty Bang Bang?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Oh, you pretty chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, we love you.
It was one of my favorites, and you know the depths to which I hate musicals.
Yes.
I actually loved that movie as a kid. Every minute from start to finish, except one little bit. Can you remember what that one little bit is?
I'm going to let you say what that little bit is, but I bet it's the bit that kept you up at night having the worst nightmares.
Until I was in my 30s. It was the child catcher.
Children, where are you? I know you're here somewhere.
There is this lovely, beautiful movie and singing in a car that flies.
You're the answer to our wishes, truly scrumptious.
Truly
adults
scrumptious.
And I had nightmares about the child catcher until I was an adult.
Cherry pies, cream puff, ice cream, and all free today.
Okay, so what's the vice versa one? What's the one that goes the other way?
Okay, so there's a restaurant in town that should be closed down for health reasons. There are safety violations. There are health violations. The people who work there are mean and impatient. The service is horrible. It is the best hush puppy I have ever eaten in my entire life.
Hush puppies are little balls of fried dough. They're so amazing because they're extra crunchy on the outside, but the inside is moist, tender, and a lot like cornbread.
So you can have the most amazing thing with the child catcher. You can be berated and sit among cockroach feces and have the most incredible experience of your life with a basket of hush puppies. When somebody says, well, is the place good or is the place bad? I'm like, I give up.
Yeah, we try to do that all the time, though, right? We try to somehow provide this summary, this overall one-stop shopping assessment of something. But it's not just often impossible to try to characterize the whole of something in a very simple way. It's also not a great idea to try to do that, right? It's not the information that we're actually looking for.
Think about statistical modeling and approaches in which we don't work from a saturated framework. So when we estimate a model and it's saturated, what that literally means is we're estimating all possible parameters. People sometimes forget it, but the multiple regression model and the general linear model more, well, generally, is a saturated model. Mm-hmm. All we're doing are taking variances and covariances, and we're rescaling them in ways that are of interest to us. If in a simple one predictor regression, we have the covariance between X and Y, and somebody says, no, you need to have X predict Y. And you say, okay, I'll take the covariance of X and Y and divide by the variance of X. And then somebody says, no, you really should have Y predict X. And you shrug and you say, yeah, okay, I'll take the covariance between X and Y and divide by the variance of Y. All we're doing is rescaling covariances and variances. That fundamentally changes when we start moving to what are called restricted models. And now we're off to the races. We have path analysis, structural equation modeling. There are 100 different variations of that. But the key is, can we impose restrictions on the model so we don't estimate all possible relations among the observed variables and make that a testable hypothesis? But then the testable hypothesis becomes the beach house. Well, is it a good beach house or is it a bad beach house?
And we've talked about data model fit before, and it's not just in the context of structural equation models. It's in the context of all different kinds of models. But let's imagine that you get some version of a chi-square value out for that particular model. I mean, from a philosophical standpoint, we know the beach house isn't perfect. And if we turn up our microscope enough, we are going to find those imperfections. The analog to that statistically is if we gather enough data, eventually we will wind up getting some significant chi-square or some amount of badness of fit that we consider to be beyond the realm of random chance. And so we have moved historically in a lot of different domains. You and I happen to be in the structural equation modeling one most of the time. We have tried to move to characterize fit in some kind of more practical index, right? Not reliant on the statistical test, but more of a characterization of the global fit. I think we run into a lot of trouble trying to do that.
Two things come to mind. The first has nothing to do with what you just said, and the second has a little bit to do with what you just said.
Because your neurons fire without any reference to anything else external.
I'm sorry, you're going to cast aspersions on my neurons?
What?
You just told an entire story that I know is going to be cut. Give me a break.
And so it was cut. It was a touching, heartwarming story about my kids taking gymnastics when they were little. Boom. Cut. It's so sad.
But anyway, the non sequitur is I want to establish that it is a first world problem sitting in the living room of the beach house on the Outer Banks and me complaining about looking into the back of a sand dune. So can we just establish that I recognize that?
Okay.
The second thing is tangentially related to what you said, which shows that I was actually listening and not staring at the unbridled beauty of a pile of sand. Uh-huh. I think the entire field has assigned itself a fool's errand by even approaching the problem with the question, does your model fit? Because that is no different than saying, is it a good restaurant? Is it a nice rental house? Did you enjoy the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
Yeah. And I've been trying to think about why we find ourselves in this position, right? On the one hand, you and I talk about regression models as being saturated or just identified. And they are, from the perspective of taking variances and covariances and just rescaling them into other parameters, also in the mean structure as well. But that doesn't stop the regression world from trying to come up with a single index of how good a job regression is doing in terms of an R squared, right? How much of the variance is being explained. And so when you ask someone, how did your regression go? Usually they answer by saying the R squared is a particular value, and we're placated by that. It's also hiding a lot of information, right? We don't know which variables are relevant and which variables are irrelevant, but somehow we're okay with that. And I think when a lot of different modeling enterprises came online, whether it's structural equation modeling or latent class analysis or item response theory or whatever, I think we have this need as simple creatures to want to summarize things simply for people. And I know within the structural equation modeling world, some of the very first fit indices, like the GFI, goodness of fit index, and the AGFI, adjusted goodness of fit index, really were created with the idea of asking, of all the variance and covariance that we have in an entire system, how much is our model really accounting for? How much is it explaining? So the concept of an R squared really was driving some of the initial efforts to come up with what we call global fit indices. But again, is there a sand dune? Is there a dysfunctional variable? Is there John Wilkes Booth? That is just... If I can just say this, I think global fit measures suck. They do. They absolutely do. Imagine that you're getting a checkup at the doctor. And so the doctor tells you on a scale of 1 to 10 what the assessment is of you. And so she says, I'll give you an 8. That 8 could mean maybe you're out of shape a little bit. Or that 8 could mean there's some issues with your heart that we probably should look into a little bit more. Those are very different scenarios. And if someone just tells me that a model has an RMSEA of 0.06, does that just mean your model's like a little bit out of shape? Or is there this burgeoning heart attack just waiting to happen somewhere? So I think there's a problem in these global fit indices from the very start.
Anybody who's in academia long enough knows that all of academia is just community theater. Everybody hits their marks. Everybody has their lines. I have a colleague who we've been on a lot of dissertation committees over a lot of years together, and his mark and line is, well, in your simulation, is your misspecification a spike or a smooge?
Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's that word?
Is it a spike or a smooge? The spike is you have the smoking gun misspecification.
Right.
That in your system of equations, you've got this bloody bullet hole misspecification. But the smooge is lots of drips and drabs.
Uh-huh.
There's just this kind of fog of misspecification. In model fit, it's virtually impossible to tell those two apart.
So there's a part of my brain that thinks about models as systems, and our hypotheses and theories are about the way systems function. And that part of my brain wants some kind of global assessment. On the other hand, if I think about the model as being this collection of smaller parts that are trying to work together, then I want an assessment of those parts. I want to know if it's a spike or a smooge. So I have a fundamental problem with global fit. Now, people use global fit. You and I teach global fit measures, right? We teach about the root mean square error of approximation and the comparative fit index and the standardized root mean square residual. We teach about all of this kind of stuff. And we should teach about all of this. But I think just teaching about that kind of stuff is gross neglect on our part.
It is. Let's think for a moment, though, why we teach those and what it may signify at a global level. Let's talk about a structural equation model, but as you noted earlier, this takes many forms across many different kinds of analytic settings.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we aspire to have what we might call, and I'm using air quotes, good model fit before we move to interpreting parameters? The motivation is that if we can say, in some way or another that the restrictions that I have imposed on my parameter space are leading to an acceptable reproduction of the covariance matrix and the mean vector that I observed in my sample.
Mm-hmm.
And more or less, we believe the differences can be attributable to sampling variability alone. What that does is it allows us a little bit more confidence that we don't have a misspecification within the confines of the model that are potentially radiating out and biasing other parameters. What drives me crazy is when people say, oh, you're just working to try to get a good model fit. And my response is, yeah, of course that's what we're trying to do. But second, if you have poor global fit, that indicates that the restrictions that you've imposed on the parameter space are inconsistent with the characteristics of your sample data.
You and I are circling around one of the big problems with global fit indices, right? And that they're not necessarily particularly diagnostic. But I will tell you, quite honestly, and this feels cathartic, can I just rail on global fit indices for a whole bunch of reasons?
Oh, let me refill my coffee and enjoy the show.
Okay. Wave at the dune for me. Here's my full laundry list of reasons I hate global fit indices. We spend so much effort in our literature, in our practice, trying to come up with thresholds for these fit indices. Oh, CFI over 0.95. And in the last 25 years, of course, it has been shown pretty clearly that there is no one-size-fits-all for fit index cutoffs. You and I have talked about that. There has been a move of late to try to make cutoffs more specific to individual models, right? The dynamic fit work of McNeish and Wolf and some others. And I think that's clever. But I still don't know how to choose the amount of badness of fit that you need to induce in order to calibrate those dynamic or tailored fit indices to figure out what a good cutoff or threshold is. And it is still global. It is still global in the sense that this model is made up of a whole bunch of parts. And you know what? Some of the parts locally are saturated. And we'll come back to this point in just a little bit. Think about a model where you have a whole bunch of predictors that are all covarying. You know what? You can't have any badness of fit among their relations. You can only have badness of fit in other parts of your model. One of the real downfalls of global fit indices is that it smushes all of this stuff together. Now, there's a really good analogy from just a simple one-way analysis of variance. And I know that some people learn about analysis of variance in its classic framing, very Fisher kind of way of thinking about it. And other people learn about it in the context of the general linear model. In the end, it comes to the same thing. But when I learned about it in the classic Fisher kind of way, imagine you have five groups and you want to know about differences in those means. What do? Well, you do an omnibus test that is like this umbrella over all the differences among the means. And then the question is whether or not those means have statistically significantly more between group variability than the within group variability, leading you to conclude that not all of these groups would have come from the same population. Now imagine writing up a study and saying, yes, we have found group differences among these five groups somewhere. Thank you very much, everybody. It would be completely unsatisfactory. And ANOVA knew this because there was the LSD test, least significant difference test, and there's Tukey's test and Newman-Cools test, and all of these, what are sometimes referred to as post hoc tests, right? Post hoc to an omnibus procedure to try to diagnose where the differences might be. I would argue that that's what you wanted all along. I honestly don't give two craps about the omnibus test because it doesn't answer my question. What answers my question is, does this group differ from that group, differ from that group?
To show how far back these controversies go, my first year stats book was Keppel.
Oh, yeah.
It's a classic in the field, and I hated it with the passion of a thousand suns because all it did was compute sums of squares 183 different ways. But this was a controversy even there. Do you need to have the omnibus F test? Because as Greg says, it goes either way, is to say, I rejected the null hypothesis that stated all group means are equal. Now I'm going to move to the discussion section. Well, nobody would ever do that.
That's right.
But I got to tell you, we very often do that in the SEM. My RMSEA is 0.049999 repeating, and now I'm going to talk about how we need to change how students are taught in public schools. Sorry, hang on, cowboy. We got a few things to look at. Because there are advantages for not referencing the Omnibus FN ANOVA, bypassing it entirely, and going straight to your group comparisons. Because if you do that Omnibus F test, that impacts the inferences that you're making in the post hoc comparisons. We're not arguing to not do an Omnibus test, but for the love of poop, don't stop there. Because you've got hush puppies and sand dunes and spikes and smooches that need to be incorporated into the Agatha Christie story that you're telling. For me, that's what I love about the Omnibus F. It is an opening paragraph where you say, it was a dark and stormy night and not all group means were equal. Mm-hmm. And then you move into your story. But other than it was a dark and stormy night, no one cares.
We are really bad in our modeling practice at moving into the story. We tend to stop with that opening paragraph, and we don't pursue this with more local assessments of fit. In the ANOVA, we go, hey, is this group different from that? Is this group different from that? We know to do that. But in the SEM world, for example, we go, hey, the fit's good enough. And we don't look locally where I think all of the action really is. I think we're very bad at it. If someone said, you get to pick one, you get to pick global fit or you get to pick local fit, I would pick local fit every time.
Every time. I completely agree. If you're interested in a more detailed conversation of the global fit, we talked a lot about this in season one. It was like model fit and the curse of the black pearl or something like that.
The code is more what you'd call guidelines than actual rules. Welcome aboard the Black Pearl.
We're not going to talk about that now. There's an omnibus chi-square test. There are a lot of limitations to that. There's the RMSEA, the TLI, the CFI, SRMR. All of these are, is it a good restaurant? Was it a nice movie? Did you enjoy the house rental? Yes or no? What we're going to talk about here is to say, all right, whether you start with that as an opening Agatha Christie line or whether you bypass it entirely, which to be clear, we're not advocating for. There are still uses of global fit, but like everything in life is everything in moderation, is let's think a little bit more closely about what is local fit or misfit, and how do we go about in a principled way to try to identify it and potentially do something about it.
There are a lot of different meanings to local fit. What's the first thing? If you are going to do some examination of what you would label as local fit, what would be your go-to for starters?
My starter is I am a huge fan of looking at the residual covariance matrix in some kind of standardized format. Mm-hmm. So remember in multiple regression, all of it is based on minimizing the sum of the squared residuals. And the residual is what we observed on the outcome y minus what the model predicts, y hat. And so it's the difference between what we observed and what we predicted based on the model. Mm-hmm. Well, you can analogously scale that up to simplify. I'm not going to talk about mean structure. Let's just focus on variances and covariances. But in some models, we can also restrict means.
Sure.
We have a sample variance covariance matrix that will denote just say capital bold S. All right. And that's literally just the sample estimates of our variances and covariances. And then we have a model implied covariance matrix, and let's denote that for simplicity, sigma hat.
Okay.
Well, notice the parallel between y and y hat. We have S and sigma hat. We have the covariance structure we observed and the covariance structure that is implied by the model. Well, we can subtract one from the other, and we have the residual covariances. That is, what are the variances and covariances that the model is doing well reproducing? What are the variances and covariances that the model is struggling to reproduce? Those are in raw metric. It's very easy to standardize those. And the very first thing I will do, and this is a reflection in the field of our lack of attention to this, It's not part of default output.
That's right.
In almost every software package that I'm aware of, you have to go dumpster diving to find the request to put this in your output. But I will look at the standardized residual matrix, and for however many observed variables you have, and you can get this for latent factors too, but you look at a P by P residual correlation matrix that shows what part of the model is doing what it should and what part of the model is not.
That is the food for all of the other fit indices. When it comes right down to it, and I like to think about it in the correlational residual way that you're describing, right? Big values there create a bigger SRMR overall. They create a bigger RMSEA because that gap can feed into the non-centrality. They create a bigger CFI for a very similar reason. In fact, there was some really nice work by Brown and colleagues a while ago that showed that all of these different ways that we think about fit can distill down to just thinking about fit as this aggregate across all of this residual information. And I completely agree with you that you should just go look at the residual information then, right? Don't tell me that, hey, overall, these are looking pretty good. Show me where the spikes are. Show me that there's smooge, whatever it is. I don't even know. I don't even know if I'm using that properly. But this to me is where there's a lot of information, not all the information, but a lot of information.
You're exactly right, because it highlights three things. In a saturated model, by definition, that residual correlation matrix is a matrix of zeros. You are perfectly replicating the covariance structure that you observe. That's the definition of a saturated model. And then the spike and smooge, I don't know, picture a 10 by 10 correlation matrix. And remember the parlor trick is it's 10 times 9 divided by 2, always divide the even number by 2, so 5 times 9. There are 45 correlations in that matrix.
Mm-hmm.
A spike is almost all of them are near zero or zero, and you got one honking giant residual correlation, and that's the spike. The smooges, they're a little here and a little there and a little here and a little there. What's interesting is you can use fifth grade math to get an SRMR value that's exactly the same for a spike and a smooge, and you have no freaking idea.
Totally on board with you. So recommendation one, take a look at those. You know, again, I prefer the standardized residuals, usually in a correlation type metric, and get a sense of the nature of your fit and whether or not there is some local area that might need your attention or at least your understanding of things. You said something else. It went by very, very quickly, but I thought it was really thoughtful. If you have, let's say, a latent variable path model with four factors that have their own structural connections among them, you can get residuals for the latent portion of your model on your own by taking those unbiased variances and covariances from the saturated latent variable model, right? If you connected all of your factors together, you could get a covariance matrix of those, and subtracting off the model implied variances and covariances among those latent variables from your model. And then you would get the residuals. And those would be unstandardized, but you could use the information from the latent variables, their variances or the square roots to get the standard deviations, and you could standardize those. And then you would have the standardized residuals for the latent portion of your model. And that might be a very, very telling thing to do because the measured variable residuals are like the echoes of what's going on. But if your model is really about a latent process, getting residuals at the latent level is going more toward the model-based source of what could go on. And I think doing that can be telling too in the context of a specific type of model.
Which brings me to arguably my favorite part of the entire SEM, and you know what's coming. You found an incredibly sharp, incredibly rusty knife, and you cannot help but pick it up and play with it. And the sharp, rusty knife are the modification indices.
Yeah.
These are directly related to the residual matrix that we're talking about. What a modification index is for a restriction in the model. Now, often the restriction is a zero. We take it out of the model, mm-hmm. but it can be any restriction. You could have an equality constraint. You could have some kind of linear constraint. But usually what we do in the SEM is for a parameter that you did not estimate, this gives you an estimate. It's not exact. It's an estimate of how much will your chi-square go down if you were to freely estimate that parameter. So this is the guy in the alley smoking a cigarette who says, buddy, hey, come here.
Come over here.
If you give me this cross-loading, I'll give you 28.23 on your chi-square. All right? Now, there's some cool things with it, because that is a diagnostic measure of local misfit.
Absolutely.
But there are a couple of minor problems. We're a cat with a laser pointer, because it's like, what about this parameter? What about this parameter? What about this parameter? It's not a priori. We're being driven by idiosyncratic characteristics of our sample data. And also, there's this thing called asymptotic mutual independence, and David Kaplan wrote a wonderful paper on this 20 or 30 years ago. But if two parameter estimates are correlated with one another, that modification index may be a misspecification that's trying to get out of one hole, but it really goes with something else. You don't know. They're taking one degree of freedom at a time. My next favorite are looking at the modification indices as a potential indicator of local misfit.
Yeah, I think they're very, very useful, and you have to be careful with them. You and I have talked about the whack-a-mole problem. The thing that I like about them, though, the correlational structure of them notwithstanding, and I think we'll talk about that a little bit more in a second, but the thing I like about them is that they are in the context of the model. Unlike correlational residuals at the measured variable level, those aren't necessarily tied to specific parameters. You can remediate by putting in particular parameters like error covariances or something else, but the modification indices are in the context of the model. It's only suggesting the release of constraints that are associated with the things that you've put into your model. So I like that it's related to the model. Now, one of the things that we know about our models, though, is that there are some places where you can't make any changes to your model. And I alluded to this a little bit earlier. If we take a giant model, whatever giant is, there are some places where no improvements could possibly be made. And you might see that in a correlation matrix of residuals. And you go, hey, look, I got a whole bunch of residuals of zero over there. Why is that? Oh, because that part of the model is locally just identified, right? There's no other way you could connect those things. But I've got a dumpster fire over here in this part of the model, because that part of the model is really the source of the degrees of freedom that you have. That's the part of the model that has the opportunity for misspecification. Modification indices are going to draw you toward those areas where you have an opportunity to have badness of fit. Now, other people have talked about doing this too, and doing it in a very principled way. There's some really nice work by Thomas Rossiel and Textor. They wrote a paper in Psych Methods. Do you know how long ago that was?
I want to say 2017.
That sounds about right. This is actually like a dream team that came together for this particular paper, in the sense that Thomas comes to this from a very directed acyclic graph or causal inference perspective. And if people don't know what directed acyclic graphs are, or DAGs as they're called, DAGs is basically what happens to path tracing when you let computer scientists turn it into a religion. So Thomas is very well trained in DAGs. Then you get Rossiel, who is the creator of Levon. And then you get Textor. And Textor created a program that's been around for a while called Daggety. I love Daggety.
I like the way you work it.
No Daggety.
I got to bag it up. Bag it
up. Daggety is a program that will take your model and it will tell you what the implications of your model are for what in your data should be unrelated as a function of your model. And that, I think, is at the core of the work that is in this paper. Think about a model, and I know you're going to hate this word. I'm just going to let you know, trigger warning, the word collider is going to come up in something I'm going to say. Are you going to be okay with that?
I'm out.
I know.
I'm going to go out and sit on my sand dune.
Think about just some of the simpler elements of a model. If you have two exogenous variables, X1, X2, call them what you want, and you have not connected those with a two-headed arrow, then those should be unrelated in your data, or at least not statistically significantly related. If you have two variables that are going into a collider, maybe your X1 and your X2 are going into a collider. But again, there's no connection there. The model implies that there should be no relation between the variables going into the collider, going into a variable downstream. And so that implies a testable zero relation, right? That those two variables going into the collider should be unrelated. If you have a model with a mediator, let's say X goes to M goes to Y, well, in that model, right, path tracers, X and Y should be related to each other. But if we control for M, then there should be no relation between X and Y. So in that case, the correlation or covariance between X and Y vanishes if we control for that particular variable. So the gist of what Dagerty did and the way that they've built this into a larger local fit framework is to think about, you have a model, and that model should imply what variables on zero order should be unrelated, and each of those is testable with its own statistical test. What variables should have partial correlations, which might be controlling for one thing or controlling for multiple things? What of those should go to zero? So now you can take your model and you can distill it down to the implications of it that are just a function of where there's an opportunity for misfit at all. And I think it's a very thoughtful way to start to look at things. Now, some people have talked about, hey, and you could make an RMSEA for that part of your model or for that parameter and all of that. Yeah, you could, but I like their idea of taking a model, distilling it down to its very specific implications locally, and then thinking about the tests of those.
Somewhere along your description, you use the word principled. Mm-hmm. When I started with the standardized residual correlation matrix, you're just going out back and looking around. Yep. When you go to the modification indices, you're just going out back and looking around and saying, oh, that one's big, that one's small. Oh, look at that. I wonder why that's there. What I love is when you work through this paper, it forces you to think about your model. And remember, what a statistical model is in large part is you're making a theoretical statement about the underlying structure that gave rise to your data. And then you're examining the data that you collected in your sample with the structure of the data that the model thinks exists given the parameterization that you define. That's the whole thing of what we're trying to do. What I love about their approach is you've got to sit down and think carefully, just as you described, is if I have this, it will imply that. If I have that, it will imply this. And it really is a sharp intellectual stick that you're getting poked with, where you have to make a formal statement about what you believe these implications are about the structure of the model. I think the other go out back and look around are really important, but I really like bringing some structure and principledness to making these decisions about global and local fit.
I recommend that people go and work through that paper a bit because it's very thoughtful. I like how you described it, that it's poking you. You should be poked, right? You should be poked about your model and the implications of the model. There's one other thing that you mentioned that I'd like to expand on a little bit, and that is that the modification indices that you get are related to each other. And we know that from whack-a-mole, right? And anytime you make a change in your model, other parts of your model, not all parts necessarily, but other parts of your model shift and adjust a little bit to deal with that. And there is literally a correlational structure for the modification indices. You could imagine just in a simulation way, there's a mathematical way, but you could imagine in a simulation way, if you ran a model over and over and over and over with different samples, got modification indices, and then figured out how all the different modification indices that were suggested correlate with each other, well, you would find that some correlate really, really highly, that when this modification index is big, that modification index is big, and when that one's small, that one's small over there, and then some that don't care about each other at all. Maybe that means they're on opposite sides of a model, and there's enough shock absorber that's going on between them. Maybe they are in some way what we might call asymptotically separable. But the point is that there exists a giant correlation matrix for modification indices. And one of my wonderful students, Christian Meyer, has worked through a lot of the mathematics of that correlation matrix. And why do we care? In other parts of our lives, we look at correlation matrices in general and we say, boy, there's a lot going on in there. I wonder if that can be simplified. The same is true of the correlation matrix for modification indices. You might have a model that has 8 degrees of freedom, but your list of potential modification indices could be dozens and dozens, even well up over 100, even though you only have a few degrees of freedom in your model. So obviously you can't make all of those modifications, and it means that they're all trying to repair things that are very, very similar. What if you take the correlation matrix among those modification indices and you do a dimension reduction on that? what you will start to find is that all of these modification indices over here are really tackling a similar problem. All of these modification indices over here are tackling a similar problem, but a very different problem from that, completely unrelated or only barely related. So some of the work that Christian and I have been doing, really led by Christian, is trying to take the information there and get a local assessment of where those spikes are. And that's really what you're doing. Hey, all of these congeal. Or maybe this modification index is kind of a one-off that doesn't have to do with anything else. And a cool extension to this, we can also get out what are called expected parameter change statistics. Now, for those people who have used modification indices in just about any software package, what it will tell you is if you make that modification, how much will the parameter that you are modifying, how much do you expect that it will change as a result? And that's kind of useful, but I'll tell you what might be even more useful. And that is if you make a modification, how much do other parameters in your model change? So what are the echoes or ripples of that modification throughout your model? So imagine you have what you might consider to be 7 really critical paths in your model, just theoretically focal for everything that you're interested in. And you're entertaining a particular modification that is really representative of this dimension in the modification space. Well, wouldn't it be nice to know whether that modification is going to do something to the rest of your model? Well, it's possible to get estimated parameter change statistics for those focal parameters in your model, because we are often faced with modifications that are just like repairing the fit of a part of our model, but doesn't have a damn thing to do with the parameters that are of interest. Like, oh, hey, we hooked together those error covariances. Okay, but all of the latent relations are still basically the same. So along with thinking about this modification index space and then thinking about the dimensionality of it so we can try to understand how it all relates dimensionally, we can also estimate information about the repercussions of those changes. And to me, that is a very important part of the local fit process.
And what I particularly like about the work that you're doing is it moves us away from the 1 degree of freedom modification indices, because that is whack-a-mole. Mm-hmm. Imagine that you have a colony of moles living underneath your model, and each mole is a misspecification.
Yeah.
All of our models are misspecified. Because no parameter is truly zero. What we hope is there are a bunch of small, weak moles that don't want to get out very much, right? Is they're like tapping on the door, but it's like nobody cares. You're a meek mole. What the modification is there might be one big burly mole that tries to get up there, and then there, and then there, and then there.
Uh-huh.
And the 1 degree of freedom modification index might give you 10 huge modification indices that's all the same steroid-laced iron-pumping mole that wants to come out. And so I really love that you're doing that in a multi-parameter, multi-dimensional space. That's very cool stuff.
Thanks.
So when you're doing this with your own work, keep in mind, is it a good rental house? Is it a good restaurant? There's utility to having, it was a dark and stormy night, and we have some omnibus evaluation. Greg and I are not arguing against those fit measures. What we are trying to argue is that's a starting point. Because imagine the two scenarios where you have an adequately fitting model, but maybe the majority of that omnibus fit is coming from a saturated part that is perfectly reproducing a huge number of the variances and covariances.
Exactly.
The bit that you're most interested in theoretically actually has a pretty big misspecification,
yeah,
but it's being overwhelmed by the big saturated part. The other one, though, is imagine that you estimate the model that is near and dear to your heart and it does not fit well. And you say, oh, my model doesn't fit well. Maybe the core of the thing that's near and dear to your heart is actually doing a pretty good job of representing that part of the data space.
Right.
And maybe way over in Western Kansas, and I'll be careful because I had to do an official apology to Western Kansas in an earlier episode,
uh-huh,
but way over in Western Kansas, Kansas is this kind of bullet hole that is driving misspecification, but nobody cares, and it's not biasing the things that you do care about. Those are fundamentally issues of local fit. So we have to do both simultaneously when we're trying to draw inferences from these complex data structures.
So I think the take-home message is global fit is okay as a starting point, but having a more thorough and principled look at local fit is really key to helping to understand whether your model has good bones overall or whether there are some real problems going on with the model's foundations. So we hope people will engage a lot more, and you have to work for it. You have to go get this stuff for yourself, right? Because it's not currently default stuff, and we encourage people to go out and get that local information.
If there's one goal we have in here, would be to have computer programs give these residual covariance matrices as part of the default output, so that right there on your screen, you can see variance by variance and covariance by covariance, what is doing a good job in reproducing your sample data and what is not.
Totally agreed. So we encourage folks to make that a part of their routine modeling practice.
I got to tell you, Hancock, that sand dune is calling to me. I just see the 45-degree day with a 30-mile-an-hour wind and the whipping sand. Uh-huh. I think I'm going to go get a cup of coffee and go sit on my dune.
Okay, you enjoy.
Take care, everybody.
All right, thanks. We'll see ya. Thanks so much for joining us. Don't forget to tell your friends to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever they go for something that makes them feel acceptable goodness of fit. You can also follow us on X Twitter, where we are at QuantitudePod, and visit our website, quantitudepod.org, where you can leave us a message, find organized playlists and show notes and syllabi, listen to past episodes, and other fun stuff. And finally, check out our cool Quantitude merch, like shirts, mugs, stickers, and spiral notebooks from redbubble.com, where all proceeds from non-bootleg authorized merch go to donorschoose.org to help support low-income schools. You've been listening to Quantitude, the podcast that's honestly a lot more smooge than Spike. Now, at this point, we usually have some attempt at humor, often with fun made-up sponsors. Today, instead, we thought we'd share with you some exciting behind-the-scenes outtakes. We're often asked whether or not recording goes smoothly, or if we have to edit because of little hiccups that occur along the way. Well, I know it might not sound like it, but usually an episode goes through 15 to 20 hours of post-processing between the two of us to deal with all hiccups, great and small. And on that point, during this episode's recording, I actually had the worst case of hiccups for the first 20 minutes of the raw recording. So here's just a sample of what had to be edited out. Enjoy. This feels cathartic. This is most definitely not NPR.